This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson, in today for John Dankosky. Back in 1990, there were more than 300 college and prison programs in the U.S. By 1997, the number was down to less than 10, eliminated as part of the nation's movement to get tough on crime. Research shows that college behind bars can be among the most effective ways to stop prison's revolving door and give ex-offenders a chance to lead successful and productive lives once they're on the outside. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with folks from the Center for Prison Education, which offers Wesleyan University classes to inmates at Cheshire and York prisons in Connecticut. We'll also hear from a researcher who's evaluated the effectiveness of these types of correctional education programs. But first, we meet George Chochos. I met him for the first time last week when we sat down in New Haven for a conversation about his extraordinary story. Just ahead, we'll hear part of that story and later talk some more with him here in the studio. George Chochos was adopted at an early age by a first-generation Greek family in Albany, New York. As a youngster, he was the lead ethnic dancer at his family's Greek Orthodox church, and he says as a young child, he never really noticed he was different from family or community until it was pointed out to him.
And it was pointed out to me, I'd say around 7 or 8. I started noticing my skin color was different than everybody else. That kept growing on me until a little bit later on in life when my parents were not doing as well inside of their marriage. And at that time, my brother had had some psychiatric issues. And I just started feeling like I didn't belong in this family anymore. And around 16, my father and I had a very blatant conversation about race and about ethnicity and about adoption, about our family. And it was at that point, I think, at least psychologically, I checked out.
And how did you check out?
I didn't want to listen anymore. And I think that allowed me to go into a rebellious stage that I really thoroughly regret. My parents didn't deserve it. I think they did the best job that they could as parents. And I started acting out. Alcohol came into the picture. From there, around 17 or 18, I got kicked out of high school my senior year for skipping too many classes. I ended up going to, at the time, there was a school called Street Academy for, I'll just say, troubled youth. Those who were on parole or had, for some reason, or probation or no other school would take them. So when I graduated, quote unquote graduated, I was in no position to try to go to college. It was at that time that I was introduced to marijuana. From there, I started in embracing a segment, I think, of street culture that was not healthy to me or healthy to my community. And I started making some very bad decisions. My first year at community college, I got into a fight with someone who's not one of my good friends again, but we grew up together, and I swung a bat at him. It hit the car, and I was charged with, I think my first felony was an assault with a dangerous instrument. I was given 3 years probation. And when I was 20 years old, I violated that probation. That was the first time I went to jail. An 8-month sentence, and I did 5 months and 10 days.
Yeah. And where were you in prison?
It was in Albany County Jail in Albany, New York. I remember my family coming to see me. My son was born during that time. And while I was in there, I decided to apply to SUNY Delhi. I applied from jail. Miraculously, I got in. I wanted to be a track coach and a gym teacher. Unfortunately, I had already started using marijuana, as I mentioned, and I made the choice that instead of being the buyer, I would be the seller. And that led me in the second semester to my first drug felony. I was given 3 years probation. I stayed at school for one more semester, but this is where I think there was a huge, huge turn. I came home and I found my brother. He had taken his life in the backyard of our home.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And it came as a huge shock. And unfortunately, I made a very terrible decision to start using cocaine, which took me on a 3-year cocaine binge. at the height of it, I was using about an 8-ball or 3.5 grams a day. From around 1996 to my final arrest in 2000, I had been back and forth for the drug charges and violations of probations and parole, totaling almost over a year's worth of time inside of those jails. All the while battling cocaine addiction. Eventually, I picked up a fair amount, around 21, 22 grams of cocaine, and used almost all of it in a day. My mother found me. I had gone into what is called a cocaine psychosis. And I was in that state, and it scared me so much that I actually stopped using cocaine before my final arrest in 2000. Unfortunately, while I put the drug down, I really didn't know what to start doing with my life at that time. So I started turning to alcohol and the drug ecstasy. I was arrested in 1999. And I guess the best way to explain it is I was in the dirty tank in Rockland County. Your throat. So there's supposed to be nothing there.
Excuse me, what's a dirty tank?
It's one of the holding tanks that you come into when you first come into the jail. So I'm in the second holding tank, and there was a daily word there. And I don't know how to explain it. It was as if not so much that it was calling to me, but I just felt drawn to it, and I took it back with me, and the only thing I could say is I started reading it. Something started to change inside of me. And not to go too far into, but I have to mention that, I literally called on the name of Jesus. My mind cleared up immediately. That's the best way I can explain it. I don't know how, I don't know fully what happened. All I know is that that's what happened. And I realized that there were two desires. I wanted to know what had just happened to me, in terms of how all of a sudden that my mind cleared up. I was completely out of the cocaine psychosis, completely. And I realized I wanted to get education. Two things that I had never wanted to do before. However, I went back to Albany. Unfortunately, I made a very poor decision to start drinking again. And within 5 months, I was back in jail with 5 bank robberies. And I was sentenced to 14 years in Rensselaer County, because there were 5 bank robberies, 2 in Rensselaer County, 3 in Albany County. And not even a year into this sentence, found myself at the infamous Sing Sing prison. As far as I knew, there were no college programs inside of prison. Except that I found out I walked into the wrong section of the chapel building in Sing Sing and saw a picture of men holding a master's degree. And it's at the time, I believe it was the nation's only professional master's degree granting, the only professional master's degree granting institution inside of a prison offered by New York Theological Seminary. It was a master of professional studies. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I don't even have 4 transferable credits to my name. How am I ever going to get a master's degree? After 3 months of being in state prison, I found myself at Clinton, which is now getting in Dannemora, which is getting a lot of attention for a variety of reasons. I was there for almost 2 years, and I started to notice that I started I knew that we could apply or a person on the inside could request a transfer, but you may not get to the specific place you want to go to. So I put in a transfer request. I was hoping to go to Eastern Correctional Facility.
Because that was the place you'd heard that there might be.
I didn't hear that there was actually education there. What I heard was, for a maximum security facility, if you have to be there, it was just a better place than most.
So you made a request. Did you get it?
I did. I was sent to Eastern. It was there that I found out that Bard College had started a program.
And we'll hear more about that program and the tough application process to get into it later this hour. I'm Diane Orson. If you're just joining us, this is Where We Live. I'm in the studio today with George Chochos, and we're listening to a conversation recorded last week. George Chochos served more than 11 years in prison during which time he earned a bachelor's degree from the Bard Prison Initiative, also known as BPI. It's a program created at Bard College, which is a small liberal arts college in New York State. After graduating from Bard, George got his master's degree while still in prison, and he's now a student at Yale Divinity School. I asked him to describe his initial response to Bard's liberal arts courses.
First couple classes that we take, well, at the time, we took Composition 1, an intro to critical thinking, which dealt with formal and informal reasoning and formal and informal logic. And that was a whole world that I had no idea. I didn't know anything about. So one of the things I noticed was, you know, we were good thinkers, but we weren't actually we weren't great writers. And so Bard put in place some non-credit grammar classes that helped us to relearn English grammar. They actually brought writers in to meet with us on a weekly basis, to where we would workshop our papers and we would go over paper writing. So my second semester in Bard, I noticed that philosophy was really what was grabbing me, and I did fairly well. I ended up with, I think, a 3.92 my first year with BPI, and then from there studying sociology, anthropology, eventually moving on to urban sociology and economics, among other courses, I think opened all of us up to a world of ideas that we had never engaged with before.
Tell me about your interaction with professors.
Well, I want to talk about that in the context of, I think, just prison culture and prison interactions.
Yes.
in general. Prison is it's a dehumanizing institution, very dehumanizing institution. And the interactions between in there are very strict. They're very controlled. And especially when it comes to staff and volunteers, it's a very set structure. It's very limited. Inside of the classroom, I think for the first time in my time of being in prison, it was where for a little bit I almost didn't feel like an inmate. I felt like a student in a classroom engaging the professor as just another a human being learning from another human being. And I think that interaction is one of the hidden or not so much talked about benefits of college and prison programs, being able to have an authentic relationship in an authentic context inside of a very dehumanizing institution. I think helps people to reacclimate to the culture and I think to society, because the interactions outside of that are not what lead to thriving in a society. I mean, the types of relationships that we have, whether it be with staff, whether it be with officers, it's not your normal interactions or how you would play out, say, in a corporate office or in other places where there's authority figures.
How did the Bard Prison Initiative program affect the way you related with other inmates?
I think because there wasn't a lot of higher education inside of prison. You know, there were almost 72,000 people in prison in 2004. And Bard College only took 15 people. It means almost for every one person that gets in, roughly 5,000 don't get in. And I knew that there were many people much smarter than I was. So, you know, people were proud for us when we got in.
What was the hardest part for you? What was the most challenging part of this for you?
Challenging part of Bard or just being in prison overall?
Well, both.
Both? Let me start with being in prison. I think the psychological effects, and I don't use this word lightly, I think the psychological damage that happens inside of prison, being, you have to redefine your life and redefine reality in a way that allows you to deal with the day-to-day situations inside of prison, which can sometimes go from having a very bad interaction with another prisoner, maybe having a very bad interaction with an officer. There's a level of tension inside of the prison and a level of feeling like you have to be ready at all times for anything to happen inside of that prison. Unfortunately, you know, some of my friends, one took his life. Another one had a heart attack 2 weeks after making the parole board, seeing people hurt by other prisoners and also by staff. I think weighs on you when you see that over and over and over and over again. So I think the psychological there's a disconnect from society that happens and from your community. And though I went in at 26, I was a very immature 26, and I came out at 37 with a lot of education, but there are other areas of my life that I was stagnant in that needed to grow, and you kind of grow in some areas and you don't in others.
Right. That yeah.
And getting out, one of the things, I know I'll back up, but just I remember getting out and I had never used the internet before. I didn't really know what Wi-Fi was. And I remember walking in, and I'd heard stories about how people had gotten out and walked into different places that were somewhat familiar, but had changed and kind of either froze or had a panic attack. And I would think, oh, you know, that's never going to be me, right? I'm only going to be 37 when I get out. And I walked into a McDonald's that I had been into plenty of times before, and people are on Wi-Fi, and it just hit me. Like, I felt like I was different. Like, everybody, like, I'm watching myself inside of a movie, and I'm disconnected from it. And I just did not feel like I belong. And that was very difficult. And one of the things I had to do, I forced myself actually to go to Starbucks every day I wanted to go into as many places that were unfamiliar as possible until they started to feel familiar. And until I started to gain a level of comfortability inside of these spaces. So back to, so that's the prison aspect. The college aspect, I wouldn't say it was so much difficult, but challenging sometimes was when we didn't have access to computers for whatever reason.
So you served 11 years?
I served 11 and a half years. I was given a, I was sentenced to 14 years out of 14 in New York State with a determinant sentence. You're supposed to do 12 years, then you can get out in good behavior. And I was released 6 months early.
That's George Chochos. I'm Diane Orson. We've been listening to part of a conversation recorded last week with George, who earned a bachelor's degree while in prison from Bard College. He went on to earn a master's degree behind bars from New York Theological Seminary. But in order to do that, he had to agree to transfer from a medium security facility back into a maximum security prison, and not just any prison. He had to go back to Sing Sing, a very tough choice to make, which he did. He was released from incarceration in 2011. He's still on probation and is now a student at Yale Divinity School. George Chochos is here with us in the studio, and we'll talk some more with him right after this break. And you can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson, in for John Dankosky. Our show today is about college behind bars. My guests are George Chochos, who earned a bachelor's and master's degrees while serving a 14-year prison sentence in New York State. He's now a student at Yale Divinity School. Also with us are Dara Young, who's program manager of Wesleyan University's Center for Prison Education. It offers classes to inmates at Cheshire and York prisons in Connecticut. And Mike McAleer, an associate professor of molecular biology and biochemistry at Wesleyan, who's taught inmates as part of the university's program. And if you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 860-275-7266. You can also comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good morning.
A pleasure to be here.
Before we begin, I want to mention, in the interest of full disclosure, that my daughter was a graduate of Bard College and worked for 2 years at the Bard Prison Initiative, the program that George graduated from. She was too young to go into the prisons at the time, but she did work as an administrative assistant on campus. Anyway, I think the first question that I'd like to throw out to you, Dara Young, you're the program manager at Wesleyan's Center for Prison Education. Why liberal arts behind bars?
I think that's a great question. I think we're all asking ourselves why liberal arts in general at the moment. But I think the type of thinking that we hope to encourage through a liberal arts education is particularly important when we're talking about people who are incarcerated. We regularly hear from our students that the experience of taking liberal arts classes is just transformative, and that when you expose people to new ideas, to new ways of thinking about the world, it helps them to understand how they got to where they got and what it is that the mistakes were that they made along the way that helped them to reach this point in their life. And I think it also helps them to understand what the opportunities are for them to change and to become different, so that when they are released, they're different people and they come out as better people than they were when they started. I also think that something very important to think about is when we talk about the liberal arts versus a vocational education, for example, the liberal arts really provide transferable skills. So if you're trained for one job and you can't receive it, where are you left? But the liberal arts teach you how to, for example, disagree with authority in a respectful way, or to persevere even in the face of challenges. And that type of analytical thinking, all of those skills help you to succeed when you walk out those prison doors.
I would say that also it's what we do, and the realm of education is huge. We're a liberal arts university. These are the courses we teach. We happen to be running this program, so we're going to do what we're going to do. And if there's other schools that have more technical or vocational skills that want to be involved, great. I'm sure there's a huge need, and there's room for all kinds of education in these kinds of systems.
So can you explain a little bit about how the Center for Prison Education works?
Sure. So we have a pretty rigorous admissions process. We've started in 2009. We had 19 men who were admitted from over 100 applicants. So our admissions rate is about that of Wesleyan's.
And what do you look for when prisoners apply? What are you looking for in an applicant?
I think the primary thing we're looking for is intellectual curiosity. It's wanting to learn and seeing learning as an opportunity to better oneself. And we assess that through a variety of means, through an essay application, through interviews with our students. And then once our students are admitted to the program, they take two classes a semester with Wesleyan professors. They take classes that have the same syllabus. It's the same material, and our expectations of our students are exactly the same as they would be if they were an on-campus traditional student. And they receive credit for those for their work, just like any Wesleyan undergraduate would.
Mike, I wonder, as a Wesleyan professor, you've taught several classes in prison. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like?
Yeah, so I started in the first year of the program when we started at Cheshire. And I was kind of reluctant, and I had some hesitation and trepidation.
What were your hesitations?
Well, I didn't think it would work. I wasn't sure that it would work, right? So I'm used to teaching very good students at Wesleyan who come in with biology and chemistry backgrounds from high schools. Usually they're at the top of their classes. And now all of a sudden I'm going to go to Cheshire and teach, you know, 19 men that haven't been in school for a long time, and who knows if they've ever taken biology or chemistry. So it wasn't at all clear that it was going to work. But I was kind of convinced about the value of the program, and I thought I'd give it a try. I had the opportunity to spend some time with it. So, and I was actually part of the small group of faculty that proposed this to our colleagues. And one of the rationales I gave to everybody, I said, listen, I'm going to give a straight class here. I'm going to give the exact same class that I'm giving at Wesleyan, and I'm giving the same lectures, the same tests. I'm going to grade them blind. And frankly, if they all fail it, they are all going to fail it. I'm not going to go in there and give a watered-down course, because this is a Wesleyan class, and we want to have a Wesleyan credential behind it. And so I went in there thinking they may all fail. And if they all fail, that's going to be the way that it is.
And just talk very briefly about the course you were teaching.
Right. So I'm a molecular biologist, and I teach a variety of courses. But one class that I thought maybe the only class or one of the few classes that I thought would be applicable is a general education class that I teach, actually based on a class I took at McGill from Professor Harper, a great teacher. And it covers antibiotics, antibodies, the flu virus, stem cells, caffeine, drugs, disease. It's basic biology and chemistry, things that you hear and see about in the news or may affect you, food chemistry, food additives, but how most people really don't understand the basic science behind it. So I thought that would be a class that I could potentially offer in prison. And in fact, I offered it at the same time to two sections at Wesleyan, and one section at night. So I'd teach the Wesleyan classes the Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday night, I'd go into Cheshire.
And
it was the most profound teaching experience I've ever had. I've taught well over 50 classes, thousands and thousands of students, all kinds of different levels. It was an amazing experience. The class was the most engaged, thoughtful, hardworking class that I have ever experienced. So it was a real turnaround. I was going in there expecting they may all fail. And in the end, out of all the students I taught in Cheshire and at Wesleyan, the highest grade came from within Cheshire. It was really a remarkable teaching experience for me, and I think for the students as well.
I remember the biology class.
Excuse me, this is George Chochos. Go ahead.
I remember the biology class that I took in BPI, and our professor was somewhat skeptical when he first came in as well. And we were dealing with ionic bonds and also DNA and the structure of DNA. And at the end of the class, he came in and told us that by far the class inside of the prison had the overall highest grade average.
Right. I'm not surprised.
Even on campus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's take a moment. We have a clip of Roy, who's a Wesleyan student, and he's explaining here what it's like to be inside his classroom in prison.
Each classroom, like each study hall, it's just almost sacred because you're coming out of this intense environment, right? This intense, we're on level 4 prisons, right? It's just really like structured and, fights, drugs, whatever. And on top of fights, drugs, and whatever, you just got people with really pissy attitudes, right? Because there's people serving 60 years, 100 years. So people are really depressed. They take it out on each other while we take it out on each other. And so it's good to get out that environment, right? Even though the environments look exactly the same, like the classroom looks like a miniature housing unit, but just our conversations down there are so respectful, even when they're loud, like they're still respectful. Outside the classroom, if two guys are arguing, you never say to the other guy, "I see your point," because you would never see the other guy point. The only point y'all will have in common is the point of attack. Right? So you guys will eventually end up fighting. But in the classroom, two guys could be arguing. Could be like really loud and they can look like really crazy. They look like those guys are about to fight. But it's actually two guys that really respect each other's intellect. And they really like hashing out ideas that maybe they're not that comfortable with at the time, but like they work them out through argument.
This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson for John Dankosky. We've been listening. That was a clip of Roy, a Wesleyan student, who's explaining what it's like to be inside his classroom in prison. Joining me today are George Chochos, who earned a bachelor's and master's degrees while serving a 14-year prison sentence in New York State. He's now a student at Yale Divinity School. And Dara Young from the Wesleyan University Center for Prison Education. Also Mike McAleer, who's an associate professor of molecular biology, who's taught inmates as part of the university's program. We need to take a moment here and talk about an important question. Let me start with this. Back in 2014, Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York launched an initiative that would have funded college classes in prisons across the state. Here's a clip of Governor Cuomo announcing that initiative last year.
The cost of a prison cell, $60,000. The cost of providing the college services that Bard College provides, $5,000 per year. Let's use common sense, the economic cost, the human cost. Let's invest and rehabilitate people so that they have a future.
But shortly after that announcement was made, the Erie County Republican Committee released a paid ad which included college students who were reacting to the governor's idea.
To graduate over $20,000 in debt while convicted felons take classes for free. I work two jobs to save enough money to pay my tuition. I don't break the law. Governor Cuomo, you should be working to help make college more affordable, not giving it away for free to criminals.
It's going to take me 20 years to pay off my student loans. Maybe I should have just robbed a bank instead.
And Governor Cuomo has dropped his plan. So we need to talk about this. What's your reaction? I mean, what about this argument that, you know, the purpose of prison is to punish people who've done really rotten, bad things? And why are we rewarding people who've done these things with an opportunity to get a degree from an elite, you know, private college?
I think it's a kind of a false conflict in the sense that, yes, college is expensive and we should be helping to make college less expensive for everybody. Right. And the overall amount of money that's invested in these college programs, particularly since the Pell Grants were eliminated a couple of decades ago, is very small. The money invested in education in prison works. We're spending that money anyways on prisons and solitary confinement and everything else, the prison complex. So giving inmates an education is good use of money. It actually pays off. And I think that, sure, I think education should be better funded for everybody. But to pit one group against the other, I think it's a false kind of shrill tactic.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would also add that right now in Connecticut, our recidivism rate approaches 90%. And when you're talking about numbers that high, you're spending huge amounts to incarcerate people who are coming in and out on a regular basis. And if we can reduce that number, and education in prison has been shown to be the most effective means of doing so, we're going to be saving ourselves so much money that, again, as Mr. Meckler said, this is a false dichotomy. We can afford to support the education of more people if we support the education of a few incarcerated individuals.
George, do you want to respond?
I do. I just wanted to read from the Department of Corrections in New York their mission statement, and it reads as follows, and I'm quoting, "Enhance public safety by having incarcerated persons return home under supportive supervision less likely to revert to criminal behavior, to improve public safety by providing a continuity of appropriate treatment services in safe and secure facilities where offenders' needs are addressed and they are prepared for release, followed by supportive services under community supervision to facilitate a successful completion of their sentence." That means that programming and rehabilitation programs are part of the department's mission in order to ensure public safety and to make sure that people go home and live productive lives, don't revert to crime. Some statistics state that roughly 30% of the prison population are second or third time offenders. That's around 15,000 people in New York State times $60,000 a year. I think if we all do the math, that's a lot of money. If there was a way to reduce those costs, if there was a way to reduce recidivism, not only does it lower the budget for corrections, but it also puts people in the best position, I believe, to become tax-paying citizens, to put more money in the tax coffers. And then some of that money that we save through recidivism can go to help defer or lower costs. One of the things I'd like to say is that for those of us inside of prison, we understand those arguments. We're very sensitive to them. We understand that many people are struggling out there. And we take that very seriously. And I think that's one of the reasons why we work so hard and why many of us that have gotten out have done everything from becoming the president's guest of honor to reducing recidivism in programs around the country. And higher education, out of all the programs that are in New York State, they have roughly – in my county, they have an 82% failure rate. Higher education – 98% success rate. I think that tells it all.
And I think another point to be made is that it's not as if we're just handing out college degrees in prison, right? And in many programs like our program, it's fairly new, we're not giving degrees yet. And there could be inmates that are taking a couple of classes. And I think the value of a couple of classes gives them the opportunity to see that education is now on the table for them. That door isn't forever closed. Maybe they're going to get out. Maybe they can apply those credits somewhere else. It opens a door. It opens a pathway for them. And while they're in prison with their families and the other inmates, it just says education is an avenue for you. We're not just handing out degrees, but it gets them on track to then pursue them for themselves afterwards. And then they're going to have to deal with the finances and everything else that everybody else does.
We have a very patient caller who's been on the line. This is Brent from New London. You're on Where We Live. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you so much. And it's Bud McAllister. I'm in recovery, and there's there's so many parallels in our stories. I apologize for being so emotional. And I'm actually speaking at a meeting today, and there's so many things to be brought up, you know, just being into philosophy, sociology, anthropology. We spend, and I want to start from a different perspective, from healthcare. We spend twice as much on healthcare as any other developed country, and our health outcomes are about 38, 39, right next to Cuba. I ran a hospital pharmacy in Haiti. We can cut our cost of healthcare in half and improve the outcome. We can, with this education program, with lean education, we can cut our prison population by two-thirds. The program that they're doing at York is already working. The Chrysalis program, there's only 11.5% recidivism of women who go through that program. I want to do the same program at Gates for men. And working with Connecticut College, I want to talk to you about coming to New London and doing the same program here. I've been on a program with John Dankowski a couple of times, Where We Live, and I think that this would just be huge.
Well, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. We have to take a short break right now. When we come back, we will continue our conversation about college behind bars. This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson, in for John Dankowski. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 860-275-7266. You can also comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll be back. This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson, in for John Dankowski. Coming up on tomorrow's show, in the United States, the number of women on corporate boards has remained about 17% for nearly a decade. We'll take a closer look at what's driving the lack of gender representation and why it matters to American business. Later on in that show, we'll also consider how teacher diversity affects student success in the classroom. That's all coming up tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, we're talking about college behind bars, and my guests here in the studio are George Chochos, who earned a bachelor's and master's degrees while serving a very long prison sentence in New York State. He's now a student at Yale Divinity School. Dara Young is program manager of Wesleyan University's Center for Prison Education, and Mike McAleer is an associate professor of molecular biology and biochemistry who's taught in prisons here in Connecticut. I'd like to invite now into the conversation by phone Dr. Lois Davis. She's a senior policy researcher with the RAND Corporation. She's done national studies on the effectiveness of education in prison. Dr. Davis, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you so much.
So you studied and looked at the effectiveness of programs that provide education to incarcerated adults. Do they work? Do they reduce recidivism? What do we know?
You know, indeed they do. What we did was we analyzed 30 years of research and were able to show that individuals who participate in correctional education programs had a 13 percentage point reduction in their risk of reincarceration. That's a very large reduction in that risk. In addition, individuals who participate in vocational training, for example, had a 13% higher odds of being employed after release from prison. So, indeed, they are highly effective.
And does it really help prisoners get jobs once they're on the outside?
It does. I mean, it really. What we see is that reduction in the risk of reincarceration really is related to their opportunities and the chances they have of finding employment and not reoffending. I also wanted just to say that these programs are highly cost-effective. We were able to show that for every dollar spent on prison education, it saves taxpayers on average about $5.
So how would you answer this question we were talking about earlier about, you know, whether it's fair to reward criminals with a free education while families across the country are really struggling to pay for college or buried in college loan debt?
You know, I think the real question is to think about what are the costs to communities and society of incarceration. Clearly, we need to reduce our incarceration rates, but also the fact that if we are paying so much for corrections, and if we have an opportunity to implement programs that actually really reduce the chances of people coming back into prison, that in the long run helps society. That in the long run saves costs. So I think it's more a discussion of what are we trying to do in terms of rehabilitation and what works.
And have you analyzed what works best in terms of the kinds of educational programs that have the most success?
You know, it's interesting. If you look at all the way from remedial education or GED preparation, college education or vocational training, then all of them are associated with reductions in the risk of reincarceration. It's hard to parse out the individual effects because they're cumulative in a sense, but indeed, across the range of types of education programs, they all are associated with reduction in recidivism.
And what about the idea of, let's say, computer-assisted type educational programs?
Yeah, we actually looked at that. The research is evolving in that area, and certainly some would argue that for this population that it's really that face-to-face time with instructors that's critical. But I think that's still very nascent. It's an important opportunity to kind of, both expand access to education as well as to kind of keep the cost down. But I don't think we have enough data yet to really assess how effective the computer-assisted programming is.
I wonder if you could talk for a minute. There's a measure called the REAL Act that's been proposed, actually co-sponsored in part by Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro here in Connecticut. Can you talk about what this is and, you know, why you think this could help to change things for college programs behind bars?
It's a very important opportunity because we actually did a survey of all 50 states, and what we found is that of those states that offer any kind of college programming, the way that it's paid for is really by the individual or their families. It's not paid by the government in any way for the most part. But what happened in the 1990s is when we changed our legislation so that individuals who were incarcerated no longer had access to Pell Grants, we saw a dramatic drop in the participation of college programming. So people are recognizing that was a big barrier that we face in terms of allowing individuals to kind of improve their themselves, pursue educational attainment. And so that's an opportunity for them now to get access to the Pell Grants to help them pay for their college programming.
I'd like to make a point, if I could, that's often made. Wesleyan University is a better university because of this program. The benefits are not only for the inmates. We are a better school that gives the opportunity to students to engage in this. They get experience in organizing. They get challenged. I'm a better teacher because I had the opportunity to teach in York and in Cheshire. And I'll just make this plea or suggestion to the teachers and the professors out there. I was very skeptical when I started. This is the best teaching experience I've ever had. If you have a chance and you can make the chance to do this, it could rejuvenate your passion for your profession. It could be the best teaching experience you've ever had.
Dr. Lois Davis, what do you think is most important moving forward?
One of the things when we think about college programming, and there's a real recognition of it now in a movement, is to really support programs that allow individuals to truly earn and work towards a degree, whether it be an AA degree or a bachelor's degree or higher education. And the reason for that is in the past, often what prison inmates had access to was just correspondence courses or individuals' courses that were taught here and there, but it really wasn't laying the foundation to working towards something meaningful in terms of a degree that ultimately would help them when they get out. And so that, I think, is an important advance in how we think about prison education.
Dr. Lois Davis, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Dara, can you explain how, related to that final question we were just discussing, how does the Wesleyan program work?
Well, at the moment, we're not a degree-granting program because we only have the space and time to offer our students two classes each semester. Even those who have been with us the longest are only beginning their senior year, or what would be the equivalent thereof, this school year. Whether and how we're going to offer degrees has been a big question, and we've been debating it and trying to figure out how to do it because we recognize that the work our students is putting in is the same that a traditional undergraduate would be putting in, and that we should recognize that work in the same way we would that of a traditional undergraduate. At the same time, I don't think that the credits that we offer ever go to waste. For our students who are released, they are able to take those credits anywhere. We have students who have been released who have enough credits to just be one or two classes short of an associate's degree. People who have transferred to UConn or Southern Connecticut straight from our program or who have been offered admissions at the new school. All of these opportunities still exist. And even if our students choose not to pursue their education right away, a Wesleyan transcript is never going to go to waste.
George, we have just a few minutes left. Tell us, you're at Yale Divinity School now. What are you studying?
I'm studying for a Master of Divinity degree, which is a professional degree for those going into traditionally into parish ministry.
And where do you see yourself going?
I'd like to go on to pursue a PhD. And I know I'm going to have one foot, I believe, always in the church and the nonprofit sector. But I'd also like to teach in a program similar to one like Bard and like Wesleyan in the future.
And do you know about the Wesleyan students who have gotten out? Do you keep track a little bit of where they've gone?
We do. We have pretty close relationships with many of our students who have been released. We only have had 12 released straight from the program. A number have gone down to lower level facilities straight before the release. We operate in maximum security facilities. That does not mean, however, that our individual students have a maximum security level. In fact, many of them, like George, choose to be in a maximum security facility despite their ability to go to a lower one, only and solely in order to be part of the program. Those students who have been released, many do go on to continue their education, and many do go on to employment. And of our students, I think almost to a one, they express a desire to, whether professionally or in a outside of their work setting, give back to their communities. They're incredibly dedicated to giving back to their communities, whether that be through economically starting new businesses or working in the nonprofit sector, working with young people who are at risk of making the same mistakes that they did. They don't want to see people end up in the same situations they are, and they believe that their Wesleyan education is really the key to making that happen.
We have to wrap up. We could talk more about this, and maybe we will down the road a piece. I want to thank you all for joining us today. This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson. My guests today have been George Chochos, who earned a bachelor's and master's degree while serving a 14-year prison sentence in New York State. He's a student at Yale Divinity School. Dara Young is program manager of Wesleyan University's Center for Prison Education. Mike McAleer, an associate professor of molecular biology and biochemistry at Wesleyan, who has taught inmates as part of the university's program. Looking for my credits here. I want to thank our guests. And our show is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. And WNPR's digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Our interns are Katie McAuliffe, Deborah Timms, and Jules Lefebvre. You can continue our conversation on the website wnpr.org/where we live. I'm Diane Orson. This is Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.